Welcome to the Service Management Leadership Podcast with Jeffrey Tiefertiller.
Welcome back to another Service Management Leadership Podcast. I have a great guest for you today, Mitchell Potts. And Mitchell and I have been acquainted on LinkedIn for some time. And Mitchell, how are you doing today?
I'm good, Jeffrey. Thank you for having me on your show.
Oh, it's great to have you on. It's great to talk to you. And so I start this most podcasts with guests on that who this is their first appearance. Ask them roughly the same question. So how did you get started on your service management journey? Since we don't go to school for these jobs. It's not like you 10 years old living, laying in your bed thinking, I really want to be in service management one day. So how'd you get started in your service management journey?
Yeah, no, I actually agree with you. No one says I'm going to be an ITSM professional, right? They usually start out some sort of career, whether it's IT or not. Allow me before I jump in to express my gratitude for being invited. I am a longtime listener. And for those of you listening to this, I encourage you subscribe, listen to his podcast. You'll get a lot of good information out of these episodes. And you've had some really highly regarded service management professionals. To be among them, I consider it a privilege. And I really echo what many of your guests have said that, I appreciate what you do so freely for the community. So where I started, right? So like many, I started out of necessity, right? As I said, no one goes to university to become an ITSM professional. I was studying for an advanced degree in psychology and happened to be working in the computer lab at the time. And during the course of my studies, I got offered a full-time job working at the computer lab in school. And so I took that job opportunity and I soon found myself in the role of managing a small team. So I went from working in the computer lab to running the IT shop for the local college. And I found myself that even though I was managing this team, I didn't really know what I was doing, right? I was working in the computer lab, fixing computers. And things were really sort of chaotic. I couldn't measure the customer satisfaction. I didn't know how many incidents we were responding to, how quickly we were resolving them. And so I realized this is not fun for us and this is not fun for our customers. So naturally I turned to Google to get help. And so that's how I ran across ITIL, right? I did a key search word for incident or help desk or whatnot. And so based on that, I found ITIL and my supervisor at the time was very supportive and she allowed me to take the ITIL training. So I took the ITIL training and I think it was like 2009, so it was still on V3. And so I took that and I went all the way up to my ITIL V3 expert. And I implemented and adapted some of the practices and processes at that time. And I was looking to solve those basic challenges. And then when I understood and was exposed to some of the other life cycle areas, I realized that we can do so much more than just incident requests, service desk. We can also track changes. We can keep tabs on all of our assets and configuration items. We can roll out a service catalog. We can measure our success or failures and improve upon them. So, back in the 90s, when people were embracing ITIL, they were looking at solving basic problems now, right? And so the real aha moment for me, Jeffrey, what service management was all about, when I was asked to teach a course. So the dean at the time asked me to teach a course in a department. It was a computer applications course. I taught this course for 3 years. I walked away experiencing how faculty consume IT services. So it gave me this understanding. And I get that not everyone is going to have the same opportunity to ingratiate themselves into the business, but everyone can do the Gemba walk. They can go out to the business, they can talk to their constituents and their partners and their business units to really understand what it's like for the business to consume Central IT. So I did that for a while. Our university decided to centralize IT. And so I moved from my sort of IT director role into a project management role. I earned my PMP and I was able to marry project objectives with service objectives. So I had my foot on both sides of the fence, so to speak, right? And we were able to incorporate resource management and service design transition principles like a service design package to help achieve overall success, not just for the project, but for the service operational, you know, readiness. And I was also able to get involved in with our ITSM platform administrator to help them implement and improve processes within the tool, right? The tool is a way to execute on the processes. So we introduced the request catalog, we introduced the service status page and some of the metrics around it as well. For the last 4 years, I've been at the University of Southern California working in the service management office, where I have to say, because they'll probably be listening, I'm not buttering them up, but they're exceptionally smart and very experienced. So I've learned a lot from that, from this job as well. And because of my experience with the catalog and request, that's the primary role I have here at USC, along with the training and OCM. I have that psychology background. So I feel they felt and I felt I was a natural fit for that. Rounding that off, so I just want to say that a big part of my service management journey has been with EDUCAUSE. So EDUCAUSE, for those listening that are not familiar, it's a nonprofit organization for IT professionals working in higher ed. And they sponsor several communities, which there are a number of topics of interest. I happen to join the IT service management community. I've been there, been active with them for the last 6 or 7 years. And you know, for those of listening that are in education that want to join the community, you don't have to be a member of EDUCAUSE to join, but they're open to anyone. But I bring this up, Jeffrey, because aside from formal training, and I think you've said this in your, one of your guests has said this in the past, and I totally agree. Most of what you learn comes through networking, some through actual training and a lot through on the job experience, but most come from networking. And I have to tell you that because of this networking with this vast number of service management professionals across the nation and even around the world, there's 1,600 members within this community. It's been really helpful to accelerate both my practical and material knowledge of ITIL and ITSM. One of the proudest accomplishments along this journey is that we in the community, some of us in the community partnered with Axelos to get on the forefront of ITIL 4 review. So there's a core of us that have reviewed every single publication in the ITIL 4 library to date. And it's been really great to be part of that experience and to feed the concerns and challenges that higher ed has into those publications. And in one example, the DITS book, right? I think the content reflects some challenges that IT leaders in higher ed have when developing strategy. And David Cannon, if you're listening, you can certainly correct me on that, but I feel that some of our feedback has been incorporated into that book. One last piece of advice that I learned early and I want to share with the audience here is that I made a lot of mistakes. Like many, after drinking the Kool-Aid, I was a bit overzealous. Like anybody that learned something new, you want to share it. You want to spread the gospel, so to speak. But I learned it's better not to talk ITIL, but really to talk about solutions to IT challenges. In the end, it's about the people that use the tool that execute the processes.
Yes, I'm with you. People over everything. And I appreciate the kind words. This community that we're building is something that's special to me. And I really want to push in on one aspect you said. A lot of people have gone through millions, in fact, have gone through ITIL training, yet we're pretty immature, in fact, in terms of practice. And so I applaud the networking groups, the ability to talk to people, say, hey, this is how we do it. Is this how you do this over there? Or can you help me understand how you were able to mature X, Y, and Z? And I think that's so valuable as we get into both a strategic and a tactical way of doing our jobs.
No, I agree. And the one comment I'll make to that is that I heard this from another podcast and I absolutely agree with it. We exchange ideas and leverage best practices, but the minute you adopt a best practice, it ceases becoming a best practice. It now becomes a good or a leading practice. And actually, I think it was Akshay that said that. So I'll give him credit for that. But I do agree with that. So just the caveat is if you're going to learn something from people, understand how your organization can use that. It's not going to be the same as when you first got awareness of that content.
Oh yeah. And that's why what was really funny to me as I went through a similar journey with ITIL V3 and the RCV test, that the release control validate in terms of the intermediate, always had the lowest pass rate because everybody's like, this isn't the way we do change management, you know, and they had to learn how to do it best practice versus the way it's always been. So how is service management different? You touched on it a little bit, different in higher education than other industries.
Absolutely. That's a good question. There's a lot, obviously, but I think what I'll do is focus on four. And these four are at a, they're what I understand and what I've experienced as well. There's probably a lot more, but I can talk to four specifically. These come from educated guesses, years of experience in the industry, and informed conversation with my peers. I do want to make a little disclaimer that note comments are based on my experience and conversations. So thoughts and opinions are entirely my own, right? That's kind of a, my safety net, so to speak, right? So the number one thing is behind the IT curve, right? So generally people have said, higher ed is about 5 to 7 years behind the maturity curve compared to non-higher ed industries. Now, I think in recent years, because of work from home and COVID and some of the pivoting we had to do, we're probably narrowing that gap, but we're still behind the industry in general. The other is we offer way too many disparate products and offerings. Yes. So we tend to support a variety of products and service offerings, and which cause issues when trying to standardize our service delivery and support. So from a customer's perspective, they don't know who to go to. They don't know what's supported. They don't know how or who to contact. And even the service provider is impacted, right? So the various support teams and service desks, they're impacted. We stretch our resources thin. It's hard for our support staff to know what we offer. And we also have a hard time retiring something. We don't like to upset the apple cart here in higher ed. And the reason partly the reason for that is that we have our employees, particularly faculty, they're quite influential. They bring in the revenue through grants. They bring in the students, right? They produce intellectual property. They tend to work autonomously. And they we have that culture of saying yes, right? Not yes if, which I currently like. And there's a saying in higher ed that institutions think that we're snowflakes, right? Yes, we have some uniqueness, but there's some common threads throughout all of the institutions. The other challenge I see, and if you've got a comment or something you want to throw in there, just please jump in.
I would also say that it depends on the size of the university or college, because some large institution like the California system, USC, may be different than a smaller one. I think of some of those colleges that have several campuses and just how disparate their faculty, staff, administration, student base is and their needs, and just trying to congeal that up versus a smaller college. The other piece is the support, my experience, I don't want to project onto you. The support being college students also adds another layer to it.
Well, yeah, I mean, we haven't got into, the different sort of personas, right? And how their expectations, you might have an older generation who wants to call versus a younger generation who wants to chat, and have the universities embrace some of those chat technologies or AI, machine learning. Some are not there and some are, right? Absolutely. Good point. Excellent point about the, even within our own industry, you're talking community colleges, four-year institutions, private institutions versus public institutions, polytechnical universities versus your traditional liberal arts college. So it runs the gamut.
Yeah, it's just hard to broad brush is all I was trying to say. And it's like everything else, the same way I would say someone at a big hospital with several hospital systems is different than a rural hospital that has 30 beds. Your experience may vary kind of thing.
Well, interesting you brought up hospital, because I make the analogy for my connections in the medical industry that faculty are often like doctors. They're the experts in their industry. It's taken them years to get to the point where they're, you know, the expert, knowledgeable in their field. And so they have a different sort of expectation when they're interacting with IT. The other challenge is governance. So we have a very decentralized system in most universities. The smaller universities, like you know, kind of were mentioning, they do a little bit better because they don't have such diversity within our organizations, right? But large colleges, universities that have separate decentralized IT suffer from governance challenges. So, you know, each business unit and college will have its own structure and budget. So, example, for the state system, I used to work at Cal State Fullerton, budget is allocated from a central fund, and a portion of that comes from a student technology fee and or brought in by faculty, as we mentioned. So for the most part, they are either answering to the provost in some cases or to the president, but IT pretty much is a self-contained unit within those business units and academic units. And it's not, the IT spend is not tightly regulated. And IT is not really, in my experience, not really at the seat of the table. There are things like faculty senate, student steering, student government, and other sorts of governance bodies out there, but I don't think they're at the level where it's quite at the high level strategy. It's more at the tactical or operational level. And so there is that representation as well. Higher ed is also known for its collegiality, where many decisions are made based on handshakes and favors. Here's a story, right? So you have a well-respected dean who has a side conversation with a young CIO who's trying to make a name for themselves. So they go into their office and they say, hey, you know, I know you're busy, but our college could really use this service. Can you just do this for me? Like, this will be the only time I ask. But then soon that becomes the norm. That form of decision-making becomes the norm. So I think as decisions need to be made quicker and with more visibility, we're going to see better governance that supports decision-making at all level. And the final is around ITSM adoption. So the same reason that makes enterprise-wide governance a challenge for higher ed applies to adoption. There's really kind of a lack of motivation, urgency. What's the urgency if you're a self-contained unit to standardize ITSM or even IT across the organization, right? So IT organizations within different business units run their own shop according to their own operating model. They have to answer to their leadership, to their faculty, staff, and students. IT services specifically for academic units are fairly unique. So for example, the School of Arts, they don't need the same services and products as a School of Engineering, right?
Right.
My colleagues in higher ed will find this funny. Geography and geology, believe it or not, are not the same thing, right?
It's like astronomy and astrology, right? Astronomy and astrology is the one that gets me.
That's another great pairing, right? You know, one's about rocks and one's about, you know, mapping out streets or, you know, I'm not a geographer, but there are differences. But the more centralized and commoditized the technical services become, then I think the more units will realize that they're just part of the IT ecosystem, right? And they realize as things become more centralized, as there are shared services that the whole university consumes, you're going to find that customers, and for our purposes, we'll use customers as student, faculty, staff, even if they're not paying, quote unquote, they have a jarring support experience when they have to use different interfaces to report issues, or they have different numbers they have to call in order to get to the right person to help them, right? Then there's the IT organization. Our leaders are too busy, or they're not seeing the value of ITSM. They're really focused on responding to outages or pressures from their colleagues or peers to deliver. They see service management kind of as a nice to have, but not necessarily part of the core business of IT, right? Processes are often implemented as a reaction quickly because, you know, it's like something happened, we need to quickly introduce change management because we had a failure and now everyone in the university is complaining, right? So it becomes reactive. And, you know, or a vendor might come and say, well, if you just implement problem management module, that's all you have to do. Just flip a switch and it'll work. And I did, if you don't mind, there's one other that I wanted to add,
sure.
Leadership buy-in.
Yes.
So another challenge to get is leadership buy-in to understand how to run IT, or let alone what even ITSM even means. And what I mean by that is not all CIOs, but many, they come through, some of them come through being a professor, right? So they may have taught an IT course or showed some skill with IT. And so they get thrown into the role, you know, especially maybe at the, like a local college level where the dean is like, oh, this faculty member teaches a database course, you know, let's have them be the director of IT, right? You know, that even happens at a higher level for a central IT organization, right? So not that they can't overcome those challenges, but they've never sat in the boardroom. They've never experienced running an IT shop. Our challenge then is how are they promoting the skills? How are they developing those skills to promote IT as a value business partner? And can they develop an operating model and strategy that elevates our role from being an order taker and, you know, to a true partner with the university, right? And I always say, you know, we are an institution of learning. We should all be willing to learn new skills from the top guy down to the guy who empties my trash.
Exactly. And I'm going to push in a little bit. You know, I've seen universities where one college would use Canvas. Those of you that aren't familiar, it's basically SharePoint for education broken down by classroom, and another would use a different product. And, you know, you think that from a service management point of view, that there's money lost just from not doing those contracts together, you know, having one centralized, the support's lost, the knowledge base cannot be shared. You know, I mean, like there's so much that can be gained by having those service management principles.
Yeah, and I may get to this later in one of the other questions that you sent me ahead of time. Uh-huh. But yeah, that's a great example. We've got on campus, I think I'll bump my head, because each academic unit kind of runs their own IT shop, they buy or build their own solutions, mm-hmm. right? So one college may have Canvas, right? Central IT organization, my organization supports Blackboard. Yes. So, right. So how do you leverage cost savings? And, you know, we can talk about how many BI tools there are. We can talk about how many lecture captioning systems there are. We can talk about how many virtual whiteboards we have. We have three just within ITS, right? You know, so it's important for us to align on a tool and get our procurement department to help us leverage, you know, bulk purchasing, our asset management, software asset management to help, you know, drive down costs. And us who deal with sort of the requirements of what do you need the virtual whiteboard tool to do to get alignment on what's going to provide the biggest bang for the buck.
Exactly. Plus you build out your knowledge base accordingly. You know, I mean, there's so much that can be gained by having that centralized. But I understand everybody wants their own, you know, and they see it like an ice cream store. And hey, I like chocolate, you like vanilla, somebody else likes Rocky Road. But you know, I mean, it's just one of those things. And I've been in organizations non-higher ed that were like that. Been in some higher ed ones too. So we've touched on this, but what processes, I tell Ford calls them practices, are the focal point of service management within higher ed? And I say that because different industries have different ones they leverage and are really keen on.
No, absolutely. And that's a great question. In fact, it is a... it's an important information for us as IT leaders within or the community group that's in EDUCAUSE I'm part of. It's very important to us to understand what's important to our colleagues, mm-hmm. right? So I did a survey recently with about 90 responses. And in the survey, I asked a very similar question. So this survey plus other surveys in the past have pointed to your core practices, processes being the focal point. So these are the same ones that have been implemented, our tried and true ones, you know, incident management, catalog, change management. Surprising enough, problem management was kind of low on the list. And it'd be interesting to do a follow-up on why problem management really hasn't been implemented. I mean, I have my own thoughts about that. Maybe that could be a separate podcast. but yeah, you find your core ones being at the top every year. And catalog is always at the top. Everyone wants to know how to build out a catalog. During the EDUCAUSE annual conference, the EDUCAUSE holds a conference every year at the end of October. And we had an in-person, well, in-person, but you know, a session. And the audience were asked the same question. And what they want to know for 2022, the hot topics were enterprise service management, integration with other systems. Mm-hmm. And I think that is more about a CSD or CMDB question, mm-hmm. right? How do we pull in our CIs enterprise-wide? And I know you're doing a talk in Pink, shout out. And also around automation, right? How do we improve ticket assignment, ticket routing by not having to rely on humans, but relying on data that we already have, relying on trends, AI or chatbot, right? Being able to do some self-service and call deflection. So those have been some of the topics. And I think, Jeffrey, the reason why these are important this year is because these are a result of adapting to remote work, right? Making it easier for customers to engage with us through the use of technology, because you're not going to be able to add 50 new bodies to the service desk, right? So how do you offset that? Well, you offset that with carefully applied technology, right? And this is really not just within IT, but also providing a single point of entry for all our customers. If I can't go to the provost's office, or I can't walk into academic advising, give me a way that I can do this digitally through maybe some sort of portal where I can connect to those people that can help me.
Yeah. I you left one out that I thought would be high because of the age of the population, students, and that's knowledge. Because students are at that age where they'd rather go Google something or look something up, search it, and want current, make sure it's current information and accurate information. Is that a given in most higher ed?
So I left that off purely by accident. I am recalling the survey, right? And I should pull up the survey results here, but no, that was top of the list as well. In fact, our USC, my colleague Robert, he's done some excellent things around knowledge center service, and our help desk uses it all the time. Our service desk uses it all the time to support our customers. But to answer your question, Jeffrey, we don't find a lot of our customers using our knowledge. Even within internal IT, for as consumers of knowledge, we don't find that they're using the knowledge a lot. So within USC or most higher ed environments, they have a internal knowledge base, which can be consumed by IT, an external knowledge base, which can be used by the campus constituents. Sometimes people roll out a public knowledge base for guests or visitors. Hey, how do you connect to your Wi-Fi? Is a great example of a public knowledge base. But I'm not seeing a lot of uptick in the use of knowledge for self-service for customers. They prefer to call, or in our environment, email. Email is predominantly the single most used way of interacting with our support agents.
Wow. And I got an education onboarding for higher ed last summer, as I was onboarded as an adjunct faculty at a big university. And what was interesting was it really drove home that these are students that are manning the service desk, and they're answering all these emails on their shifts. And they would point me to knowledge bases, of which I, like the people you just mentioned, did not look up, but just asked follow-up questions. Because there's so many systems that you have single sign-on that tries to get you in, and so on and so forth. But it just made me think that it's great to know what your constituents, which path they take, so you can staff accordingly.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure we're serving up knowledge as a part of resolution, incident resolution, but proactively, like searching knowledge before you call the service desk, I don't think that's happening.
Wow. That's interesting. I mean, I say, because the people who call a service desk are usually older. People who'd like to search, usually younger. I don't think I could ever see my now teenage kids ever calling someplace and waiting 5 minutes on hold. They just are in that immediate generation, and they'll be in college soon. So we talked about higher ed, and what are some of the challenges unique to higher ed, especially you could talk from an IT point of view or a service management point of view?
Sure. If I may, I wanted to share two other real quick.
I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. No, that's fair. The reason why I want to share this, because I think this is super exciting. We're finally at a point where our constituents, right, are asking about how do we speed up delivery and reduce risk. So we had a really big effort last year around DevOps and change enablement. We had a three-part series where we're talking about what is change enablement mean anyway? What is it really and how is it different than change management? So talking a lot about creating standard changes, starting with the simple, right? Creating standard changes, you know, testing, you know, having some automated testing, leveraging those tools to deploy and roll back if there's a failure, localizing local cabs. So we're seeing some of those conversations as well. Again, that's why I'm super excited about that, because it makes change management seen as less arduous. And I'm careful to say seen, right?
Yes.
Because that's how we perceived it traditionally. And that's how it's been in some ways implemented in the past. And the other one I want to mention real quick is an uptick in product management. As we try to respond quicker to customer demand, we're spinning up product groups, right, to work in more agile ways. So I'm seeing more product teams. I'm seeing hiring of product managers. And because we all know that now, especially if you're going to deliver a product or service through a waterfall type of project, it's going to take too long.
Right.
By the time the project is done, the business needs have changed or it become obsolete. And as we kind of talked about, in a really unregulated, non-governed environment, I can go out and buy my IT. I can get Dropbox storage. I can go with a Blackboard online for my learning management system. So why do I have to wait for IT? As we try to prove our value, I see organizations, central IT organizations, embracing more of a product management mindset.
Got that. And I've been places where supporting from a change point of view, two groups. One says IT's a bunch of imbeciles. We want a daily cab. Another says IT's a bunch of imbeciles. We want one big, big, strong meeting. Everybody attends every Tuesday, and we're going to vet every change that impacts us. You know what I mean? Like, and so some of that is just to offset the poor behaviors, poor delivery of years gone by. You know, people bring that baggage.
Absolutely. Because there's a lack of trust, right?
Yes.
When you trust your organization, trust your providers, things get done so much faster.
Yes. You know? Yes. So I jumped the gun a little bit, but
no worries.
So what are some of the challenges unique to higher ed? And I say that because there's so many ways to look at those challenges. Sometimes they're opportunities. Sometimes, hey, these are really obstacles.
Absolutely. And I'll give you three. Uh-huh. We have kind of an expectation of what I might, how much I might talk here. So, you know, kind of going back to the governance and adoption challenges, right? So we've talked about how higher ed is really kind of akin to a feudal system. And every time I think about feudal system, I think of like medieval times with kings and gestures and, you know, knights. But, you know, in reality, that's kind of a good analogy because, you know, there are these fiefdoms, there's kingdoms, and there's really a challenge to centralize that experience for customers. So that's number one challenge is centralizing the experience from our customers, understanding their journey, right? So each school, you know, runs independently, has an IT leader that's accountable to their administration. You know, and I think my colleagues are going to kind of resonate with this. If IT, so IT organization, central IT organization, it lands in one of three places within the university. It either lands under an administrative unit like finance or HR. So they become very administrative system focused. We'll make sure we have our workday implementation rolled out to make sure we have our budgeting right, our user records right. So it becomes very focused on administrative and we lose a little sight on academic. Conversely, if IT reports to academic affairs, you're focused on your academic and educational services and you may lose sight on running the business, right? Those administrative functions that need to run the business. If IT, it's my personal opinion, if IT reports to the president in its own division, you're gonna have better alignment. So the challenge there is where is IT positioned within the organization and the effects of being, you know, under one group or another.
Yeah.
Another challenge that we have is really to understand the true cost of a service. I think you mentioned on your podcast, It's $9,000 a minute for an outage.
For
it's
a medium-sized company. And that's just for a medium-sized company. And so like the Facebook ones that, or like Microsoft had in March of this year, those were way, way more expensive. And I think for a university, if it happens on, let's say, the week of enrollment in August, it could be way more expensive than that.
Yeah, and I think that's important to, for higher ed to understand that the true costs of an outage, for example, right? Or true cost for service request fulfillment, right? So that's one. That's another challenge we have. So, you know, at most, there's often a demand for like a showback, right? People want to know, okay, how much are my, you know, students paying for IT services, right? You know, and in most of our services that we offer, we don't charge our students, we don't charge our faculty, right? We're not a pay by, you know, use model. And, you know, in that situation, you know, the IT is often seen sort of as a cost center or a money pit. Like, I will tell you, when I worked at Cal State Fullerton, I worked there during the recession. And boy, oh boy, that's when we had some serious conversations about how much is it costing me to consume this IT service. You know, you've got a guaranteed portion of income that comes from the state for each student. You have a dollar amount that's given to each business unit or academic department to spend on IT. And it's not often highly regulated. And the last challenge unique to higher ed is defining our customer. So there are a number of different types of customers that we have in higher ed, from students, faculty, and staff, to visitors, to alumni, to parents, to guests, to donors. So there's a vast number of the different types of customers. So understanding their particular needs becomes a challenge, onboarding and offboarding them. And, you know, in some cases, our customers even have access to services long after they retire.
Yeah, I was thinking about that. Think about, and I'm not you, but the audience, how many times, and we think there's a great resignation and you know, normal corporate life. Think about the churn of IDs and permissions and everything else that goes on in higher ed. That's just mind exploding kind of numbers.
Well, absolutely. And you know, that is a challenge. That's more of a tactical kind of challenge. But yeah, offboarding is almost non-existent for many of my peers. Onboarding is sporadic at best, right? You know, we do the best we can to identify, okay, this person's starting this day, they need this laptop, they need this desk, they need this account. But you know, if you have somebody, especially a contractor, when we hire a contractor, if they're sitting in our cube for 1 week without access to a system, how much money are we wasting?
Exactly. Or, you know, it took me 2 or 3 weeks to get onboarded at the university where I taught. And thankfully I just taught one little adjunct class and we got it taken care of it ahead of time. But I think of that experience and multiply that times tens of thousands of people, you know, in some of the bigger universities. And
well, and I think, and also one more comment to that. I think one of the, why it's such a challenge for people is that because if we are, we need to start value streaming those particular, you know, onboarding as a request, value stream that. But if we don't have an owner for that particular process, whether it's HR or IT, there's even multiple HRs within the university. So which HR owns that particular onboarding process for new employees? So, you know, ownership, and again, that goes back to governance.
Yes, and that we didn't, and I don't want to go down this rabbit trail, but you didn't even mention, what do we do with all the data governance or the, you know what I mean? Because the amount of data you have to worry about as getting public funds and all that other stuff is way more than most people realize.
Sure.
And so we've talked a lot about higher education and how you said it's closing the gap in terms of the lag with other industries. What are some of the other trends you see in higher ed that may not be as apparent in other industries?
Sure. I will give you three. So these, I pulled some of these from the EDUCAUSE report. So EDUCAUSE every year produces a top 10 issues for IT. And I think it's a great article for us in IT and in higher ed to refer to. So I'll give credit where credit is due. So the first one here really is about student engagement and success. So our challenges in higher ed deal with, you know, student success, right? And obviously other industries don't really have that kind of issue. So, you know, we've got staggering student debt.
Right.
Students have difficulty finding a job after graduation more than ever. Yeah. We want to ensure that our students graduate in 4 years, right? We call them super seniors when they've just been sticking around for a long time. Dealing with attrition, why are students leaving in mass numbers, right? Mental health issues, access to digital tools to participate in online courses is becoming more and more necessary because more and more courses are being offered online. And not everybody has access to a hotspot or a laptop to be able to take those online courses. So the institutions are trying to be proactive. They're creating predictive models using IT, data warehouses, and BI tools so that they can do intervention before it's too late. So like bringing in advising, providing access, like I said, to the laptops and hotspots, providing mental health services, ensuring that our students are successful, not only when they graduate, but successful while they're a student, both mentally, physically, and emotionally, right? And it really requires this collaboration between the units to share data and have those tools to interpret the data and have the people to help, support that.
Yeah.
So that's kind of one area, is that student engagement success. Did you want to have something you wanted to add?
Oh, no. And I would even push in on the student safety, whether it's online, in-person, physical, cyber safety, cybersecurity, all of that. You know, my personal safety on campus, or, you know, not being bullied. Plus the other side is the institution's safety in terms of cybersecurity. So now we have, however big the university is, you have a lot of people on the network.
Well, and true. And as far as information security, right? It always hits the top 10 for many, many years. It's been in the top 10 as far as cybersecurity and information security. So absolutely. And as far as physical security, you know, some campuses like USC, we've got a police force mm-hmm. on site. Cal State also had a police force. And, we've got those blue light poles. You're probably familiar with those. They're spread throughout campus. Somebody can ring them. And that's an important service. You know, we've got emergency services that IT has to provide support for, right?
Yes.
If those are down and we are not aware they're not working, somebody in emergency tries to call for help, they're not going to get the help that they need. To me, that's a huge risk.
Oh, yes. And I just meant, though, with universities, especially if you think back of what I was like at that age, you know, and you multiply times a university, you just think, man, there is a lot of risk type of conversations that must be had.
Yeah, and we were fortunate enough to have security very visible within the university, you know, so, and all the university reports have to be accountable to our security group, so.
Yeah.
The other sort of unique challenge to higher ed is just to keep competitive. So, you know, adapting the educational model to compete and to provide that digital experience. So I don't know if you're aware, Jeffrey, over the last 20 years, we've seen a double digit decline in the number of higher ed institutions. I had the number somewhere, but I know it's not comforting to know how many small colleges have not survived, right? So there's way too much competition. There's perceived, you know, diminishing return of value, and costs are really high. You know, cost of education is only going up.
Right.
And so we've got online only universities competing with traditional brick and mortar universities. You know, we're trying, you know, many universities are trying to adapt to and go to online, but they're not always successful because maybe the planning part of it, there wasn't a whole lot of thought about how do we not only convert our courses to online, but how do we provide the training to our faculty to teach online. And I told you earlier, I taught for 3 years. The first half I taught in the classroom, then we went online. So I recognized that it wasn't just a matter of trying to take my existing materials that I used in person and just, you know, create Adobe PDF and put it online. It's much more than that, right? So it's using instructional designers to help you create those courses, but that's another topic.
And let me throw in a shout out. Helped me, a woman named Adrienne, she was awesome in terms of-
instructional designer, right?
Yes, just to walk me through here's what you need, QA in it, make sure it's good. So I want to give, she doesn't listen to this, but you know, those people are valuable.
Absolutely. And that's a skill set that is going to continue to grow and be needed within institutions. You know, then we've got like free or low cost sort mm-hmm. of educational websites. Back in my day, we called them MOOCs. Are you familiar mm-hmm. with the term MOOC? So for those that are listening that doesn't know, it's massively open online courses. So things like Udemy, Coursera, Khan Academy, they're offering, you know, skills and trade development at, you know, less than the cost of a university. You know, and then even YouTube, right? If I want to know how to put, I bought a new desk and I went to YouTube to learn how to put it together, right? So you can get very marketable and, you know, marketable skills by just learning through online. You know, even Google, right? They're competing because they've got this Google Career Certificates, right? Yes. In 6 months, you can be trained to be a developer. You don't even need to go to university, right? And then there's even competition among the universities. Take our rival across the freeway, UCLA. Why does one student choose to go to UCLA versus USC? Now, UCLA, I mean, none of the UC schools are cheap. USC is not known to be inexpensive. But removing the cost factor, what compels a student to accept one university over another? Besides the traditional, they've got a better arts program, or USC has a great film program. I think IT is a differentiator, right? So what competitive advantage can IT give to the university to attract more students? Things like pervasive fast wireless, mm-hmm. providing an app that allows food insecure students to find places to get something to eat, offering flexible online courses. The list can go on, but IT in universities need to embrace how do we make our university using IT to make it a competitive advantage. And the final one is about staff and faculty recruitment and retention. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we talked a little bit, Jeffrey, you were saying that you had some instructor designer help you to convert your content to online, right? Or take your content mm-hmm. online. It's those kinds of skills that we need to transfer or work with our faculty to make sure that they not only have the technical skills, but have the pedagogy to be able to deliver online courses and do it effectively, right? So they're shifting from teaching in a classroom to online. Recruiting and retaining even employees, you know, this great resignation or reshuffle, whatever you call it. We're having a hard time finding qualified people to take jobs that, you know, are meaningful, are exciting, are relevant, right? Because they utilize new skills and, you know, current skills. So it's a challenge to recruit and hire both staff and faculty in higher ed.
One thing you mentioned about the technology, and I just want to touch on, we can go move forward, but I frequently say every company, and I think this is especially true with higher ed, every company is now a technology company, because you cannot have higher ed without technology. You can't have a hospital. You can't have a bank. You know, we are increasingly all becoming technology companies or technology universities just by being so reliant on those. I don't know if you disagree with that.
No, and that talks to our earlier point about having IT sitting at the table, mm-hmm. working with our decision makers and leaders to move from, yes, we can do that for you, to here's how technology can solve a problem that you may not know you have, or, you know, at best, here's a technology or a solution that can help you address a challenge, right? So it's moving into that sort of relationship.
Oh, yeah. I mean, think of it where it is now, where it's going to be 10 years from now. We may be consuming bits and bytes of education on our phones, 10-minute segments at a time. I mean, you just never know.
Well, COVID is a, COVID's awful, right? I'm not going to talk about, you know, the impact it's had on our lives and our family lives. But when you can make, you know, make lemonade out of a lemon, we have adapted technology to support things that we never knew we would need to do, like health checks, prior screening before you come to campus. Yeah. Creating an application that students can use to run through a health questionnaire so that they're safe and other people are safe when they come to campus. It's a problem we didn't know we had with a technology solution waiting to solve, right?
Yeah, so, it's amazing. And so that's why people think when we go back to the way it was, like, we're never going back. It's just the new normal is being shaped differently as we go forward.
Absolutely.
So one thing I've noticed about service management and higher ed, but I defer to you as being an expert and me as just an outsider, is that stakeholder management. We touched this on this a little bit, but you mentioned the word personas. But I just think about all the roles that intersect and consume IT services within a university setting. Is that something that you've seen, like that you have to build out? Okay, what does change look like in the education school versus business school? And how is this change that we're about to approve going to impact tomorrow's football game, so to speak, or whatever? You know what I mean? Like, is it different? Is it that noticeable, or is it more subtle?
Well, I mean, you brought up a really good example. I didn't have this in my notes, but since you brought it up, I want to use an example. So yes, absolutely. You're referring to service changes that are going to impact other schools and departments, right? So, you know, because each unit might have its own change management process, it becomes very important to us and challenge to communicate effectively with the right impacted group, mm-hmm. right? So do we invite all of the IT leaders that are not in IT, but local IT, to a CAB to hear what's going to happen? Well, maybe that's too late because the next day the change is supposed to be implemented, right? Mm-hmm. You know, do we blast the whole university that this little change is going to go in? You know, you don't want to communicate to the wrong person, right?
Right.
Otherwise it looks like we take down everything all the time, right? So that becomes a challenge, is communicating changes and getting people to participate, not just outside of IT, but even within our own IT teams, making sure that people are following change management. Really the other sort of challenges or around communicating, understanding different customer needs is trying to understand how our different customer groups use our products and services. And you actually brought up an example that I was going to bring up and to provide some context around, which is great. And by the way, don't discredit, you were faculty for a while. So you're one of those customer groups. So you have insight into what you need from higher ed IT as a faculty member, right?
Mm-hmm. 8 weeks a summer is, it's different than those people that live it. 8 weeks every summer is different.
Sure. Now going back to that. So, you know, you might have a service. So services don't typically change often. You know, in higher ed's been around for a really long time. So we've kind of gotten it right as far as the type of services we provide. Where we have some challenges around meeting stakeholder needs is how they use the products and service offerings to achieve a business outcome. So you brought an example around Canvas, right? Canvas, Blackboard, Moodle, all learning management systems. Those are the products that support a learning management service, right? But employees use a different service or a different product to support learning and development needs. They're not going to typically use Blackboard, Canvas, or Moodle, but they're going to use things like Pluralsight or Cornerstone or Udemy. Yes. To get their training they need as employees. They're all learning management services, but we're using different products and service offerings to support that. Email is another great example. Google email for students versus Microsoft Exchange for faculty and staff. So it becomes a challenge understanding how our different customer groups, what their needs are, and offering the right mix of products and services to meet those needs.
Wow. And I threw the offhand football game and example out because I know some stadiums that have free Wi-Fi, so to speak. And so, you know, how do we put that in? And I was thinking like graduation weekend or alumni things where you have a different one, and just how it's so fluid versus manufacturing environment, which, hey, it's the same every day, all day, every day.
Well, and we usually get IT usually get called into the mix fairly late in the game.
Yes.
you know, you brought up these special events. We call them like special events. So it's like by the time IT is aware that this event's happening, we may not know until the last minute. So the organizer has the room reserved. They've got the guests coming. They have the invitation sent out, but now they need a wireless SSID that their guests can log into, or they need a lavalier mic and a sound system, or they need to be able to connect to this application to check in attendees. So it's very challenging because of that kind of value stream we're talking about.
Yeah.
We may not enter the picture until the last minute.
Oh yeah. And then you have to think, okay, what changes have we approved already that might impact this at the last minute? Or
that's true too.
Something else is, I'm gonna have the service management hat on. Something else is down, and do we use the same resources or do we just leave it be because, you know, we have this big event going? Or, you know what I mean? That it's all the same service management that happens in other industries. It just may look a little different.
Well, I want to make a point like about addressing, you know, and I'm like you, I don't want to present a problem without trying to come up with at least some ideas around solution, right? And what I've seen to be effective is that, you know, yes, you have these different stakeholder needs, whether faculty, staff, students, alumni, getting to solve some of that or getting in front of that requires a partnership with those business units and departments. So, you know, we've got faculty that are really kind of doing their own thing. You can think of them a lot like contractors, right? They're there to provide a service to the department and produce either research or teach a course, right? And so they have a lot of autonomy. Business units that we talked about have a lot of autonomy. And unless there's a way to bring feedback in or establish some sort of relationship, you know, as we get to sort of talking about business relationship management, you know, we need to take advantage of some of these existing student and faculty councils to ensure that we're understanding their roadmap for the future. What projects, what initiatives, what challenges are they facing that IT can start partnering with them early on to help co-design a solution, right? IT that uses relationship managers to interface with these different areas will have a better chance of aligning the IT portfolio to business outcomes. And I want to give a shout out to my good friends at Purdue that have an exceptional business relationship management program.
Gotcha. And I was just thinking of the ability to avoid technical debt, the ability to align resources, you know. People always want to talk about, oh, you just want to be involved early because you want to be at the big kids table. Yes, but we also want to make sure we spend resources supporting the products and services that you're going to use from 5 years from now instead of investing in something that's going to go away.
No, that's a great point. I'm glad you brought that up because they're definitely, you know, I think there's been attempts at the project intake or project request intake process to identify even before it becomes green lit to align their need with an existing product or service, right? How can, you know, for example, I talked about the four different flavors of cloud storage. Why do you need Dropbox when we have OneDrive or Google Drive? What is Google Drive or OneDrive not doing for you that you think you need Dropbox? Well, I need something secure and Dropbox is secure. Well, let me show you how Google Drive complies with all the cloud security requirements. Let me show you how you can manage it. Oh, I didn't know that. A lot of times it's like, oh, I didn't know you did that. And that solves it. And yes, saving money, saving resources. Higher ed has way too many projects, but yet we have a lot of operational needs. So I'm really glad you brought that up.
I understand. And the thing is we all default back to our comfort zone. And I'm guilty. And you know, you go to a certain new company and they're like, okay, what BI tools are in place? Oh, you don't have my favorite. So let's put in my favorite. Now it's number 15 or whatever, you know, and you collect them like trading cards.
And well, yeah, so they just may not be willing or understand or take the time to say, to invest in learning that standardized tool. And I think a guest you had one time talked about, you know, experimentation, let people use the tool that they want to use. I agree to a certain point, but there's also value in providing maybe one or two types of tools, right? Yeah. So.
Yeah, and making those a part of the catalog and having a special escalation process for something that deviates. just to help with the budgets and everything, and even the support of them. It's easier to support two than 25.
Absolutely.
So Mitch, it's been great having you on the podcast and join us this week. Do you have any parting words for those looking to work or interact with higher ed?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I appreciate you having me as your guest. And I honestly think that, you know, now is a great time to work in higher ed. You know, we mentioned earlier, there's a lot of job opportunities, a lot of new and exciting types of roles that are being created out there for higher ed. You know, this has really kind of opened up the job market, and salaries in higher ed traditionally have been lower than, you know, private sector. But I think you're seeing that gap narrow. I think you're seeing the market, or sorry, the salaries be competitive with the market. And even, you know, a lot of institutions are open to the idea of allowing remote or at least a hybrid telecommute, job, you know, situation. And, you know, traditionally higher ed has always wanted to be like, you will be on-prem, you will be, you know, on site. But because of COVID, you know, and working and the success of working home, people, organizations are willing to entertain, you know, a sort of a remote working. And, you know, I was talking to a colleague over at Pennsylvania State, University of Pennsylvania. They're very rural. They have a hard time getting any real, like, they hard time attracting talent because, you know, they may not offer, they're not offering remote work. So how do they recruit that talent when, you know, that university is in the middle of nowhere? Who wants to live out there? You have to be flexible to draw that talent. Anyway, I think universities are starting to open their mind to that. And you know, go ahead.
All I was thinking is the disconnect by saying, yes, we want remote students, but not remote workers. You know what I mean?
Really, like, good point. Yeah.
It just seems like a disconnect. Sorry to interrupt you.
No, that's, I never thought about that way. Yeah, we'll accept students from China and all around the world, but we won't entertain. That's a good point. I'll have to take that back. So the other thing is in higher ed, you know, really starting to embrace use of modern technology and frameworks, right? You know, you see a lot of shifting to the cloud as legacy systems are retired. So it's an opportunity to get in the forefront and learn new skills. You know, learn about containers, learn about cloud, you know, learn about automation, right? Learn about machine learning. And I think you're going to see, like, because this is a cultural shift is happening in IT and higher ed IT. So we're embracing, it's a time right now, we're embracing a work environment where our leaderships know that there needs to be trust. There needs to be psychological safety. There needs to be meaningful work. We don't want to lose any more employees, right? You know, when people are leaving in droves and higher ed. And so, you know, offering where work can be enjoyable and trust is there is important. And I think you see some of the removal of traditional hierarchical structures. So, you know, pastors of room and like, you've got to report to your manager who report to their manager. You're seeing some removal of that. DevOps teams, you're seeing a lot of DevOps, you know, come into the picture where people can self-form, self-organize and be deterministic, right? And then, you know, using those technologies or acquiring the right skills. And lastly, I want to say, you know, the number one reason is for the people, right? If you're excited about education and, you know, educating, being part of the educational process for young minds, they're going to be the next leader of the world, then I think working in higher ed is for you. You know, it may seem like the work that we do in higher ed or even in any organization is like, oh, I'm just a programmer or I'm just a help desk analyst. You know, or I'm just an admin assistant. All of that is that service value chain, right? We sit within that, within that service value stream. We sit in there. We may be one or two removed from the direct interface of the customer, but what we do is part of the ecosystem and we directly contribute to their success. And anyone that knows me knows that I love ITSM, but I am truly, truly a champion for higher education. So come work, make a plug. We've got two job openings at USC, one's for an ITSM process analyst and one's for a ServiceNow developer. So
awesome.
You know, contact our HR department.
Awesome. And I just was thinking that the easier we make it on students, maybe it's the one thing that helps them stay in school. And, you know, I mean, like there's a lot of stressed out students and however we can make that life easier for them, the better.
Absolutely. It's the interaction. You know, you always say, I remember, you know, my fourth grade teacher. I remember my high school teacher. They really encouraged me and helped me grow. Well, that, you know, going to university gives you teachable, you know, marketable skills, right? It teaches you a concept or a theory, but you grow as an individual. And I think faculty, you know, staff, even people in IT have an opportunity to give them a positive experience as they form their impressions about the world, as they become their own independent thinker and learn to think for themselves. That's really that experience that college can provide. And I want to say this one last thing too, is, you know, in this remote way of providing education for students, they're missing out on some of those social interactions, right? Not just the frat parties, right? But those, you know, those opportunities to do work for the community, those opportunities to sit at some dorm room 12 at midnight pontificating about what it means to be a human, right? It's those kinds of experiences that you get in college.
Yeah, I just think of, I got my MBA when I was young, right, for bachelor's and master's. And everybody's like, what'd you get out of it? It was a long time ago. I was like, it helped me think. It helped me.
Yeah.
I grew up in a very blue-collar household, wasn't challenged to really think. And, you know, just the ability to challenge you to think and how to form thoughts, if I got nothing else out of those 2 years, that's still very valuable.
Absolutely. And you know, the audience may be asking, well, how does IT impact that? Well, what if we develop an application that like a forum where students can go in and generate ideas, have an upvote or downvote, you know, like emoji.
Mm-hmm.
Technology can enable that. We have to think creatively about how technology can enable some of that, because I think it can.
Yeah, even the experience of the consumers. I'm big into experience management. What's experience management look like for students? Anyway, it's just so diverse of a thought process. I thank you for joining us, Mitch, and we'll have you on again soon. And I hope you and the audience have a great, great day.
Thanks for having me, Jeffrey.
Oh, no problem. Take care, everyone. Bye.
Bye.